Okay. So this reading, it was when I got to the discussion of agnosis last week when I was preparing for last week's phone conversation. I got to this section on agnosis and I thought, you know, this really deserves its own week. So that's why I broke this chapter up into two parts and then decided in looking through it all that we really needed to go slowly and take our time. So that's what we're doing. Basically what it looks like what's going to happen is we'll take all three quarters, all three programs this year to go through the space section of dynamics. And then the natural thing would be to turn to the time section next year, but I won't make any promises, threats, or predictions. We'll just see how it develops. So agnosis is the central theme. You know, it's actually very interesting that agnosis somehow seems to have a very strong impact on people. I've had many people mention it to me over the years, and I've gotten a little bit of feedback personally this week on the readings that it was a very striking concept. In fact, Rinpoche spends very little time on it, but it does seem to go to a very fundamental element of what he's trying to present about space. And for us, I think the challenge is going to be to see how we can take the idea of agnosis and using one of these words that is really not a word, operationalize it. You know, how can we practice with it? How can we bring it into our understanding, our perception, our way of acting in the world? And of course, that's an issue you could say with the TSK teachings in general. It's always the challenge, and part of the tremendous strength and power of TSK, I think, is that it's not satisfied to stay at the level of theory, of presenting some compelling new picture of the way things are. It's constantly trying to wake us up to the truth of the way things are. And in order to do that, it presents all sorts of different models and understandings. So that's our responsibility is to respond to that. And agnosis is a good example because, after all, when Rinpoche introduces agnosis here at the very beginning of the reading for today, the interplay of knowledge section down at the bottom of page 38, he calls it a transitional move. You know, it's not, let's say, the truth about space or time or knowledge, but it's a way of engaging space and time and knowledge that helps us get beyond what he called in the previous paragraph from last week. It helps us get beyond the density of identity, the substance of what appears. You know, we're so committed to the substance of what appears, and as a result, we have lost space, which is something that he refers to in this excuse me, that he refers to in this section also. We need a way out of that. You know, he says at the beginning of or at the end of the last reading, he says we can see the consequences of being stuck with identity, the friction and frustration that are generated when objects and other established entities interact. So that's a nice image because the word friction there, you know, it suggests something very tangible, very solid. When everything is made up of substances, they may have different kinds of substance, but when it's all identity and substance, then everything is always rubbing up against everything else and producing friction. Or you might think of trying to walk in a heavy, in a snowbank. It's very difficult to get anywhere. You're always sinking down into the slush. okay, this is the alternative to that, or an alternative to that, that he's proposing, which is instead of focusing on identity, and this is at the very top of page 39, we can focus on the non-concretized act of projection. So what he's suggesting is that we can think about space in a dynamic way. Space projects. And some of you will probably have been reminded of that sentence in the first TSK book, at the very beginning almost of the TSK book, where he says, space is projecting space into space, and that's all. That projection quality, which he really is developing more here in this reading, is an answer to our usual way of seeing things, or an alternative, a move away from our usual way of seeing things into a dynamic. Space becomes dynamic. Space projects into mind, and as he says, then mind has to project a knowing capacity out into space. And then the move that he makes in order to introduce the idea of ekgnosis, which he does in this first paragraph on page 39, the move that he makes is to say those two projections, the outward projection of knowledge, which we would ordinarily say comes from the mind, and the inward projection of space, the projection of what appears into the knowing capacity of the mind, those two are not separate. The outward projection of knowledge remains available inwardly, and he calls that an inward outward knowing. And the word, he says, he's making up this word. There are some related words in philosophy, and theology, but this word is a word that he's made up. He calls it ekgnosis, an inward outward knowing. So it's not a knowing by the subject. If anything, you could say it's a knowing by, or that's not so good, a knowing inseparable from space projection. The projecting activity of space already has a knowing capacity built into it. So I don't usually like to bring in quantum physics. I mean, people are often struck by the certain parallels between quantum physics and TSK. I think they're useful up to a point, but then they can be confusing, or they can limit you. You can start saying, "Oh, I know what that means," and you say, "It means what quantum physics says." No, it doesn't. Nonetheless, in this case, I'm going to bring in a couple of points about quantum physics that I've been reading about a little bit lately. I'm no expert in quantum physics, but I try to tune in. And Rinpoche himself is always very interesting. He's always interested in developments in quantum physics and string theory and things like that. He's always saying, "Well, what's going on there?" I think he feels that someday there may be a connection established. I'm probably not the person who's going to establish it, but maybe someday the person will come along who can make that connection. But there are two things about quantum physics and the understanding of space or space-time, usually talked about in physics, that are relevant here. One is that space is dynamic. It's presented that way. A term that's used a lot nowadays is that it's kind of like a foam. that space and time together are like a foam. They're always kind of bubbling up or fizzing up, and that activity is ongoing, and that's what projects the universe. So this is a similar, it has the same flavor, let's put it that way. And the other thing that is being talked about quite a bit in quantum physics this way is that projection is a projection of information. Of course, we would say knowledge, not information. But first of all, they say it's digital, but that the universe is really a communication. And that's very much also related to this idea, or at least a nice analogy to the idea that the knowing capacity and the projecting capacity of space are inseparable from each other. There's this inward-outward knowing of ekgnosis. I'm going to pause there for a moment because maybe people have some questions or thoughts about it. There's almost certainly somebody, one of you, knows more about the physics side than I do. Maybe you'd like to add something. One of the reasons I thought about that is that at Rinpoche's urging, I subscribed to Scientific American, and the most recent issue, well, not the March issue, but the February issue, is the cover story is The Quantum Universe, and the subtitle says, "Could foam-like fluctuations rule space-time at the tiniest scales?" So that's what I've been thinking about, and clearly, there's some overlap or some possibilities for communication there. Okay, that's not the main focus. We don't, this is not a class that tries to deal with quantum physics, although there are a lot of people interested in TSK who make those connections. We're interested in the experience, of in our own experience and how we engage the world, how we experience the world. And in part that means how we experience space. Of course, ordinary space, you'd say, well, that's just it. We don't experience space. Space is what's not there. Space is nothing at all. That's what we looked at in the program in the fall. So what Rinpoche is saying here is that when we experience something, anything, it could be an object that we perceive, it could be a thought that we have, or a memory, or all the different kinds of mental activity. Whenever we experience something, we could understand that as an act of projection by space, right? That space is actively, dynamically projecting experience, and in order for that to make any sense at all, you really have to understand that space has built into it, inseparable from it, a knowing capacity, so that it's this inward-outward knowing. That's really what Rinpoche is trying to introduce here. And so if you say, well, the object that appears is a projection of space, that's not quite right. Because in that case, you're leaving out everything that's not the object. What you have to say is that there's a projection of the whole, right? So it's not, as he says, it's not a superficial knowing outward. It doesn't start from the perception or the focal setting of the subject. It emerges from the inwardness of space. I'm just reading these terms from the second paragraph on page 39. And then, here's the point that we really want to focus on. External object and physical space, subjective knowledge and mind, all come together like partners in a dance, merging in mutual recognition and agreement. So that it's not taking one perspective. This projection is not a projection from a particular point outward, which you might think of it as a point that originates in an object being projected into the knowing mind. You might think of it as the mind projecting outward a knowing capacity, Both of those are wrong. Both of those are too limiting. As he says, what appears can equally be understood as a projection of mind into space, or as a being reflected back from space into mind. And in that connection, and I'm still just kind of following along because this is dense and detailed material, and I want to make sure we're clear about it. He says, when we talk about ekgnosis, about an inward-outward knowing, it's not limited by the idea of radiating out from a center, right? The known, he says here, the known and the unknown are projected. And you could also say the knower and the known are projected. He doesn't say that here, but it seems to me to follow. When he says the known and the unknown are projected, he's really saying it's the whole, right? The inward-outward knowing, or the inward-outward knowing of ekgnosis is the whole of what appears, including the one to whom it appears, and the act of appearing, and all of that arises together. And because it's the whole, it includes the unknown as well as the known. Those are just, the two possibilities within the whole, right? The whole is bigger than the known or the knowable. It's the known and the unknown, the knower and the known. It's all possibilities. All of that needs to be understood as an inward, outward projection. And I think it's because it projects the whole that, as he says here, however it takes form, whatever projection it supports, ekgnosis widely opens wisdom. So I want to compare that to a couple of different things. One is the standard picture that we have, and I always like to emphasize that we may say, well, we have a, I mean, we may not say this, but inwardly we're thinking, we have a more sophisticated view. Most people have a kind of a naive or not thought through understanding of space and time and knowledge, and but we've been studying TSK, and so we have a more sophisticated view. And in a sense, that's right, but it's also true that we just buy into things because of the way we've been raised. We just have a particular understanding that's so deeply ingrained that it's very difficult to notice. So the ingrained understanding that we have can be understood as Cartesian, as dualistic. There is the subjective realm and the objective realm. There is the self that's born into a world, that kind of dualism. And the way that Descartes talked about that was he said there are two kinds of things. There are things that have dimensions in space. Res extensa, res means thing in Latin. So res extensa and res cogita, which is the thinking thing. And the two are completely separate from each other, and that means that what thinks has no extension in space. And that's based on the idea of space as somehow physical, as the realm in which physical things show up. And space then has nothing to do with the mental. Of course, we're operating with a very different set of possibilities. We're saying that space is the capacity, space projects outward and inward and in all directions at once. This knowing capacity, which is what presents the world. Or you could change the emphasis in English and say, is what presents the world. It's what is the immediate experience of this moment, which, because we're talking on the level of experience, always includes the what is experienced and the one that's experienced. The two really come together. So we need to overcome that understanding, and that's why I wanted to at least identify it, of space only being in the physical realm and the thinking thing being the race cogita, not having anything to do with space. It does. The two are completely connected. The two are completely interdependent. As he says, they're like partners in a dance. The second model that I wanted to mention, it's not one that we use anymore, but it's interesting. The Greeks had a very different theory of how perception took place, and particularly visual perception. You know, our theory is roughly that there's a light source which bounces off a surface, and then it's reflected into our eye, and the eye processes that those light rays that have been reflected and identifies them as something or other. That so the source of the perception is the external light source. The Greek view was that the source of perception was a light that emanated out from the eyes. And there's a technical term for that. If you look it up in philosophy, it's called emission theory. The basis for knowing is the knowing capacity that the lights radiate out, sometimes called the fire in the eyes. You know, and you can see why someone would think that. That's not more true than the scientific view. And in fact, you know, in terms of the way that the physical world works, it's less true. It doesn't really make sense. But it does capture something about this knowing capacity as being essential to perception, you know, as being essential to the world. And that's true in particular, and I haven't seen this discussed. I mean, I was did a little research on this for this class, but I haven't seen it discussed in detail. But the goddess, the divine force that puts this knowing capacity, this fire in the eyes, that puts it into the eyes, is Aphrodite, who is the goddess of love. And that bringing in the capacity of love, of a kind of a heartfelt connection, I think that starts to get a little bit closer to ekgnosis. Those are a couple of things to think about. They're not, you know, we don't need to know about them to continue.
I ask a question?
Sure.
Would it be fair to say that space is the most active element in all this? That knowledge is kind of more along from for the ride. That, like, when projections talk about it, it's always space doing the projection.
Right. But it does talk about the body of knowledge, right? At the end. Let me make sure I've got that right. Yeah. So if you look
But
at
that
the...
sounds like more like something that's just there,
Well,
like
let's see. Let's take a...
inhabiting.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take a look at the bottom of page 40. The last paragraph talks about that. It says, knowledge as ekgnosis. So now here it's saying knowledge as ekgnosis, radiating outward from the inward heart of space. Understands limits differently, not caught up in separation. It discovers within and beyond each limit an aura of knowledgeability, the radiant, luminous body of knowledge. So I see why you're saying, you know, like the body of knowledge is there and we discover it, but that discovery, it seems to me, depends on the interplay of space and knowledge. I'm not sure I'd privilege space.
Well, having knowledge is so inherent in space, or space knows, kind of relaxes the idea of space being empty. It becomes full of knowledge, or a carrier of knowledge, or expressing knowledge, and that's equated with the heart. It gives it, in terms of the realm of experience, it gives it an emotional, affective tone that's useful in terms of experience.
Yeah, I think that's good. And I see that we have a couple of comments here that I should look at here. So let's go to the last one. So both of these are, you know, are bringing in some Tibetan Buddhist ideas. So Bruce says, I've attended some Dzogchen retreats where a similar model of perception was presented, similar to the Greek model, you mean? Bruce, is that what you're saying or suggesting? Yes. Okay. Yeah, I think it's worth exploring that. You know, there's a general principle that I've found in more in the Buddhist perspective, but is that in the time of the Greeks, let's say, there were some basic ways of understanding that are more that are closer to Buddhist ways of understanding. It's partly, you could say, a kind of a temporal thing. You know, Buddhism has stayed with a kind of knowing that was, in some ways, like the knowing that operated in, you know, 2,000 years ago in our own culture, and has long since been set aside in our culture, but continues to operate in Buddhism. So yeah, I think it's well worth exploring. I haven't explored it in any detail. There is a book called The Fire in the Mind, which I have on my bookshelf somewhere, but I have never read too far into it. Okay, and then Sudhi says, how does the TSK vision see the cosmology of the beginnings that Longchenpa talks about, of going astray of luminous knowing that is a priori, okay, and the becoming or going astray of the three potentialities of the subject, object, and the body via the proliferation of postulations, the mistaken modes you have here, mode, mistaken mode of appearance. Well, that's a lot to ask. So there is a going astray, you could put it that way. I think that's right. And I think that's the main thing that you know gets presented in TSK, that there is a way of understanding space that emphasizes what appears in space and loses sight of the projecting dynamic of space, which is what we're focused on here. How does that happen? You know, that's a question that I think takes a little while to give an answer to. I'm not sure I want to try right now. Is there some nice one-sentence way of saying it? The key, it seems to me, is that once it's happened, once it's happened, then you look back and try to figure out how it happened. But before it happened, and I don't mean before in a temporal sense, but I mean in the realm where it hasn't happened, then that's not a very interesting question because it hasn't happened. Maybe that's helpful, maybe not. As I say, it takes a little bit of, you have to kind of think that through. Okay. I would like to get to go just a little farther so that we can actually practice with this possibility and see get some feedback on that. So there's this knowing capacity that projects outward. It's inherent in space. It's more fundamental than space in the ordinary sense. It's this. You know, it's the deepest, maybe you could say, the deepest level of space. And at that level, you know, there are no positions, there's no source, there's no from, there's no to. Rinpoche talks at the, I think toward the bottom of page 40, somewhere in here, he talks about flexibility and fitness. And that's fine, but it's more than that. It's actually at the top of page 40, right before the heading. He says, "My way and their way give way to a broader way, communicating and understanding variously. We replace disagreement and positions with flexibility and fitness." Well, that's really worth thinking about because it gives it a little bit more of a practical dimension to it. You know, we don't get caught up in positions, and therefore we don't get caught up in disagreements. And it's because, you know, there are no positions are taken. On page 41, Rinpoche says, "Ekkgnosis moves without departing from its space origin." So there's a movement, but there's no movement in space, you know. Where could it go to? It's all space. It's all this inward, outward knowing. So what I'd like to do is see if we can practice with this a little bit. As he says, we're talking about a knowing that does not radiate from a center. And you could say, this is probably not a completely accurate way to say it, but you could say it's a knowing that is projected from all appearance. In other words, wherever you look, but of course it includes the one who looks, but you know, let's not try to do too much at once. Wherever you look, there is this knowing capacity of space. So the things that you encounter, and let's do this practice in terms of the things that we perceive in the world, the visual, you could certainly bring sound into it or the other senses. But for a few minutes here, 2 or 3 minutes, let's see how that feels, how we experience that, and what it is that we want to experience is that there is a knowing that is the projection of what appears. You know, no solid content, just a knowing projection. And that's what we experience in the world. Nothing else. We don't lose anything by that. In fact, maybe we gain a lot. But it's just kind of within ordinary appearance and experience. So let's hope that's reasonably clear. Let's try that for a couple of minutes. And then we'll see how people respond, okay? Okay, let's take the opportunity to reflect on that. I just want to make a small observation. I was thinking about it. You know, when I teach a class in person, when we do a little practice at the end, I usually ring a bell. But what I do here is I take my image, I put my image back on, I put the video back on, so it's using a different sense modality. It just struck me as kind of funny. When Jack shows up, it's time to talk. Uh-oh. Okay, let's see what we have. David says, "There's so this practice has been, you know, seeing everything as a projection of this knowing inward outward capacity, really." So David writes, "They're seeing a range of appearances, then interest is piqued. That interest is like a magnet drawing a desire to engage with something. See relationships, qualities, feelings that accompany this engagement." Okay, well, that's good. I think what you're pointing to there is that when whatever we perceive, there's no separating that out from the subjective realm of our reaction to it, right? There's interest, there's a desire to engage, there are relationships, qualities, and feelings. And in one sense, you could say, that's how we know that we're talking about a knowing dimension, right? That's how we that's why it's kind of crystal clear that there isn't a kind of dead world out there, the one that the self reaches out to know, so that all the knowing comes from the self side, that it's completely different from that. Just the opposite of that.
I had an experience that as I relaxed, my knowing of things, the experience was more of the things being revealed.
Hmm. That's a nice word, reveal, revelation. I like that. And it makes sense. There's a kind of another word that comes to mind. There is a kind of a disclosing. You know, that whole family of words. It's the possibilities here, you could say, are a lot less aggressive, you know, because it's not as though we're reaching out in the world to get something. Okay, good. So Bruce writes, "The practice started out for me as a feeling of knowing space, all appearances being a space projection of forms and flavors of knowing. But then it shifted when I saw space itself, space as distance, as container, etc., as knowing appearance. There was a sense of vertigo, surprisingly, as space disappeared." Okay, well, that's good. I'm not going to try to comment on that. There's a lot of possibilities here. You know, it's very different from our usual way of understanding. And yet in my experience, when that manifests, it's like it's crystal clear. You know, somewhere in this chapter says, if we can see with clarity, we can really get over this substance-oriented view. And I think when you engage appearance as a space projection, and that in some way, at some level, makes sense to you, then it does seem just, you know, of course, you know, it's very clear. But on the other hand, Bruce, you're pointing to, I guess, really something a little different. It may lead to vertigo. It may lead to a kind of dizziness because, gosh, that's not the way things are supposed to be. Okay. Michael says, "Sometimes two people, selves, can't talk without old angers arising. Oneself can't independently fix this and can't put the communication onto a kinder appreciation of a greater whole. Then a silent withdrawal seems best. Two are needed to talk." Well, that's, you know, you take that in a really interesting direction. So the interactions with people. I think that's related to something that struck me as a certain point when we were practicing, and that is, when appearance is a space projection, it also involves the past of whatever appears. And so if we're dealing with people, then, you know, people have their histories. People have their interactions. And there's an unanswered question implicit in what you say, Michael, which is, you know, let's imagine that you're in a situation and you really are comfortable with the sense of space as a knowledge projection, not quite the right way to say it, but space and knowledge intertwined, and your interaction with the other person is a part of that projection. But if the other person doesn't see it that way, what does that mean? Well, that's a projection too. Okay, and then Sandra says, Sandra, you posted this privately. You probably didn't mean to. But it's a good question that you ask. Is this knowing going on in an advanced state of meditation? Ah, well. I'm not sure if you meant the in there. There's two possibilities. You could say, do you have to be in an advanced state of meditation to do this? No. I mean, we just tried to do it, you know, with some sense, perhaps, of the possibility there. It's available in any moment. If you're asking, is this knowing like an advanced state of meditation? Well, it could be. You know, it might be that you know it in a relatively conceptual way. You know, you can kind of impose this layer, this possibility as a layer of experience, that appearance is really a ekgnosis, is really an inward-outward knowing projection. And if you do it on that conceptual level, then it's not really too related to meditation, but although it may be a good gateway. But if you can engage it so that really is just the way things are, that possibility is the actuality, even though it, at a certain level it just stays a possibility, but it's the actual of the possible or the possible actual. If you can do it on that level, then that is something like, it seems to me, an advanced state of meditation. But perhaps I shouldn't say that, because generally I try to keep this separate from, you know, meditative practices. Because Rinpoche does. He's not. It's why he gives exercises in TSK, not meditations. Okay, well, great. Work on this, you know, when you feel like it, when the occasion arises, when you think of it. See what it's like to engage appearance in this way, and if you like, you can connect it back up to, or you can try practicing it in terms of your own thoughts, or a kind of a very interesting halfway place to look at this. I think I'll probably write about this in the orientation, is in looking at memories, because if you have a memory of a space, of a place, really, of something that happened in the past in a particular place, you could say, well, that place that you're remembering is certainly, in some sense, a knowledge projection, right? So there's something to look at there. Sudhi has a comment, which I will just mention here for those of you who are on the phone, just saying that this clarity relates for her to a very sharp hearing, so a very detailed and sensitive hearing, a pleasant ringing in her ears. So that's something you might want to experiment with. Okay, we'll go on to the next chapter next week. Thank you very much.